The good news is that I'm going to give you some of the late hot oil on communication among primates, chiefly non-human primates. There's some very exciting things going on. The other night, you'll recall, Saturday night, I think it was, I discussed pheromones as a very precise method of communication. It's a fantastic method of communication, especially among the insects and among many of the mammals. It extends into the non-human primates, especially the prosimians, and probably also extends to people. And we just got into that before they rang the bell for Vespers. So we didn't really get to pursue that. I also talked a little bit about pigs, one of my favorite subjects, a few nights before that. And there's one thing I forgot to tell you. I don't know if you've read one of the great bestsellers today. It's called The Hog Book. For $10 from Doubleday, you can get it. It's not the greatest book on pigs, but it's pretty good. But they teach you something about communication in pigs there. Most of you have probably told your children or your grandchildren that pigs say oink. Pigs really don't say oink. And I want you to know that. You remember the other night on pigs when you were there, I tried to straighten out a lot of things about pigs because most of you have misconceptions of pigs. You think they're dirty, you think they're dumb, and a lot of other things. Well, all of those, of course, I proved were untrue. I also mentioned we even don't give them credit. Remember I showed you my shoes, my so-called hush puppies, and now everybody in town are calling them hush piggies because that's what they are. I mean, a pigskin. So whenever you go to the store now and you buy those kind of hush puppies, you don't ask for hush puppies, you ask for hush piggies. Now what pigs really say is groink. That's G-R-O-N-K, groink. Or they might say rock when they're startled. They may say wee-ah when they're intruded upon. When they say ronk, they might mean for a colleague to move over. They might say barf when they're happy. They say a lot of other things, but that isn't the subject of today's talk. When somebody asks them, Edu Svensk. That's the chief. She's all set up for this, although I didn't put her up to this. Thank you, chief. Now, as I told you before, I've spent much of my life observing animals and they me, and as of now, they are ahead. And I spent much of my early life with on the farm with pigs, sheep, and dogs, and later birds, and I talked to them, and they talked to me. The one thing that has really fascinated me are the non-human primates. And I haven't managed very many primate colonies, although I have been a consultant. I'm a member of the scientific advisory committee to the University of Washington Primate Center, which is, I think, the leading primate center in the United States. I've also served an advisory to the Primate Center at University of California, Davis. I've been fascinated to watch them. Most of you have watched them in the zoos, and some of you I used to show on Jane Goodall's film here. And it was out of that people came to a better knowledge of the communication among non-human primates. And one of the things about them, because everybody says, well, the chimps are the smartest. They're the smartest. And if they're so smart, why can't they talk? Now, it isn't that people haven't tried to work with them to get them to talk. And I'm going to describe some of these for you. But first, I'll give you some of my experiences with non-human primates, but emphasizing more the experiences of others. There's some interesting macaque monkeys, sort of like related to our rhesus monkeys, called the Japanese macaques. And they have them in an interesting situation, one area in Japan, where there's a stream coming in and it's salt water out here, and it's, I think it's kind of a peninsula island. In a way, they're confined there, but they range in there. And what they would often do is to bring their food to them, and they'd throw the grain near the beach, or they'd also throw them spuds, sweet spuds, potatoes. And one day, a bright young female, without having studied physics, picked up the grain with the sand on it, because up to that time they'd pick up the grain from the sand and with the sand, there'd be some sand in it, and then they'd have to pick off each grain, you see, and eat it. She scooped it out and threw it out in water. And of course the cereal floated and the sand went to the bottom. And then she'd just pick off the cereals and eat them. That's a pretty clever deal. Pretty soon some others noted this, and they'd wait out in the water for her to throw it out. And then they'd get it. And some of her family then, this was extended to some members of the family. And they learned quite a few other things by observation. But this didn't still tell us a great number of things. It also told us that some were stupid. There was one colony that they often formed colonies. And there was another one. And there was only one male member of that caught on to this. And none of the others did in his household, so he left them. The other thing they did was to, on the potatoes, they would take the potatoes out and they'd rinse them off in the salt water, because the freshwater stream was drying up. And they got the taste of, like the taste of salt water. And so even when the freshwater stream came back into operation, they'd still go in the salt water, and to eat the spuds, they'd just dip them in and taste them. And then they got to liking the salt water, and some of them took up swimming. And they did just go out there and just sort of swim around, dive in, and having a great time. So there was a good deal of learning in here under those circumstances. Some of the primates have been taught to work. And the techniques they've utilized are rather interesting. They've used nemestrinus, the pigtail macaques out in Malaysia, to pick coconuts. And they get them at about three and a half years old, and only by punishment, no reward, only by punishment. First they have to teach them to climb up and take the coconut. First they have to learn how to twist the coconut on a vine to pick it. So you got to twist it to get it off. The other thing is you had to teach them how to a ripe coconut from a fresh one. But by punishment the person teaching him had him under his thumb, as it were. He was the dominant. They could get these fellows to pick coconuts. They usually went on strike at about 7 years of age. They refused, but for several hours each day they'd run them up those trees, and boy, they'd throw coconuts like crazy, because they're just like people. They have a penchant for things that go boom. So, yes? I don't know. The question is, why would they use this technique? It was cheaper, I guess, for them rather than to reward them. I that bothered me too. Why they should just use punishment for them. Yeah. I don't know if they tried it. But in a lot of the tests, for intelligence tests on the non-human primates, they do use rewards of them. They like M&Ms, raisins. Some of them are really hot for applesauce. They play shell games with them. You know? Puts things under the shell, and which shell is it under? One of the most interesting stories on baboons. There was a lady in Southwest Africa, a native lady there who taught baboons how to herd sheep. And she worked at this. In fact, I think that's how she made part of her living. And she'd trade these baboons, and the baboon would ride on the back of a ram. And he'd clutch onto the wool on the back of the ram. He carried a stick. And this is how he herded the sheep. He'd run out and keep them in the bunch. And if a jackal or something about the size of a jackal would come and bother the herd, he'd get the old ram over there chasing after him and beating on the jackal with his stick. If they're a leopard, of course, is the worst thing that you can run into, or a cheetah. A cheetah and a leopard are two real enemies. That if you're herding sheep or if you're an ape, that's something you avoid. And he'd scream for bloody murder. He'd scream like bloody murder whenever he saw a cheetah and a leopard. And he'd try to herd them away into a more secure spot, but he'd scream, for the farmer then would come out with his gun and take after the leopard. And these apes would fight to the death to defend the flock, is what was written on this. Another interesting thing about them is that there were certain trees that had fruit on them that the sheep liked. And whenever he came by one of these trees, he'd haul off his, he'd jump off his ram, his pony, sort of, and he'd climb up in the tree and shake the tree and shake the fruit out so the sheep could enjoy the fruit. He also made sure, and he seemed to know, they sensed, which lamb belonged to which ewe. Of course, ewes know this, but sometimes they get lost, and they appeared to be able to identify these, which was rather interesting. So much for them. My own experience, we became interested in gibbons, in the ape, because we were doing cancer research. And gibbons manifest a cancer that's very similar to the cancer in people and children. It's a leukemia type thing. And my associates discovered a virus that causes this, and then we found out that there was a high incidence of cancers in a colony of gibbons in the CETO lab, the Southeast Asia lab in Bangkok, near Bangkok, Thailand. So we became very interested in them, and then one of my associates sent him over there. And he came back with some material. And sure enough, we found the virus there too. Now it's quite a number of viruses, and I'll tell about this probably later this week, I think I'm scheduled. But our interest in it was then to assemble quite a number of gibbons. Now they're an endangered species. And but we were able to find quite a few of these, and we got one of them from University of California. We got some material from University of California at San Francisco, but the zoo out of San Francisco, they had a gibbon, a white-handed gibbon, a Hylobates lair, that they wanted to sell us. We advertised for it. The reason they wanted to get rid of him is that he had a scar on him for some reason, maybe injured himself or something. And when you have any animal in a zoo that has a scar on him or something, you better hide him, because you'll get 1,000 calls a day. They'll tell you about him. And all you'd be doing is answering the phone. So that's why they wanted to get rid of him. We went down after him. And the rule is that sometimes non-human primates are very interesting. They make good pets. My advice to you is never make a pet out of anything in the wild, especially non-human primates. I've seen them bust up more families and households than you can shake a stick at. Well, and the rule of this is that when they get older, they're hard to get along with. They're like some of us. And so this was a 10-year-old. So we went down there, you know, and we had the cage all ready, and the keeper was going to bring him out. And he disappeared into the vault, and pretty soon he came out. And they were in a hold and hug. This was a day of partying, and it was a sad one. And here he comes out with him. I'll call him Judas, because that's what I named him later. So he came out with old Judas, and old Judas, we put him in the cage, and they had a sad goodbye. So Judas joined us. Now, the reason I call him Judas is that we already had another pair up there, and they were expecting a child. And we had to, because of our research, we had to get blood samples from them periodically. And we had them in a fairly large cage. Now, if you walk in the door of the laboratory and you got these big cages in there, and you're intent on getting a blood sample, they already know it as soon as you walk in that door. You may not have or reveal anything on you, but they know. And to catch them to get the blood sample is a challenge. There's some question as to who belongs inside that pen, who belongs outside the pen. And they're fast. And what we discovered was that, but they're very curious. And we'd take old Judas in by the hand, and we'd stroll in there next to the cage with Judas. And when Judas got near their cage, of course, they were very disturbed, and they'd reach out to grab him. And then we'd grab them, you see. And believe him, that's why I call him Judas. And we'll call this couple Tinker and Bell. One day we had a person to come to speak to us about his experiences in Southeast Asia and Malaysia and all, because we were very interested in the animals there. And he, among other things, he played us some calls, some vocalization from that area. And I said, you know, you got to play some of those songs out for our chimpanzees, or for our gibbons. And so when he finished his lecture, he went out there, and he played some that weren't the Haile Gebrselassie's lair call, the gibbons. And then he got into the gibbon calls, and have you ever heard gibbons? I used to be able to imitate them. I was practicing up there. My roommates or people living in the same place probably wondered about it. Something like that, only a lot of variation. A lot of variations. And they can say a lot of things this way. Sometimes they start in the middle of the night. But they're going at it all the time. Well, he played, and as soon as he got on the Haile Gebrselassie's lair on this particular call, Bell, the female, came over to the edge of the cage like it was the Indian love call. And her mate, Tinker, he was completely incensed. He was pounding like this, and that's one method of communication. You know, among the chimpanzees, sometimes they beat their chest and they tap a certain rhythm. That's a signal. That's a means of communication. And then he jumped up there, and they also do it by brachiation, by slapping onto, when they brachiate, you know, you grab and whirl around. And he grabbed that bar, and he went around so fast you could hardly see him. He was really wheeled off. I'm not sure what was being said, but there was a reaction. Another aspect of this I may tell tonight, and about their mourning. I think that's enough for that, and we'll go on then to some of this communication that has been studied, and this started a long time ago. Some of you have heard about the famous diary of Samuel Pepys back in 1660 or something, and he made this entry into the diary in about that time. By and by, we are called to Sir N. Batten's to see the strange creature that Captain Jones hath brought with him from Guinea. It is a great baboon, but so much like a man in most things
that though they say there is a species of them, I cannot believe, but it is a monster. I do believe it already understands much English, and I am of a mind it might be taught to speak and make signs. This is very important, you know, to make signs. I want you to remember that. And later on, some other people in the 1700s made this following observation. Why should the elucidation of monkeys be impossible? Why might not the monkeys, by dint of great pains, at last initiate after the manner of deaf mutes the motions necessary for pronunciation? It would not surprise me if speech were absolutely impossible in the ape. And then Yerkes, who was very famous in primatology, he started the Yerkes Laboratory in Florida, which is now moved, and it's one of the primate centers. It's associated with Emory at Atlanta, Atlanta, Georgia. And he stated this way in the 1920s, I think it was, I am inclined to conclude from the various evidences that the great apes have plenty to talk about, but no gift for the use of sounds to represent individual, as contrasted to racial feelings or ideas. Perhaps they can be taught to use their fingers, somewhat as does the deaf and dumb person, and help to acquire a simple non-vocal sign language. Now, in science, we have a lot of this. We don't often read the literature, and so you don't, you know, it goes on, and then somebody suddenly rediscovers it. And I think to an extent, that's what happened here. A lot of people, through the years, tried to teach them sounds. Peter was maybe a five-year-old chimpanzee, owned by a man named McArdles, who had trained him for about 2.5 years. He was employed by Keith's Theater in Philadelphia as an example of a monkey who made a man out of himself. And so they used him for entertainment and charged money for it. And they tried to test him in the psychological clinic at Philadelphia. This was back in 1909, so it's a long time ago. And they tested him on a lot of things, opening boxes to obtain articles, unlocking locks with keys. I forgot to tell you the other night, pigs really know how to open locks. They know how to open doors, and they're very clever at this. It could also, this particular chimpanzee drove nails into a board. He did a lot of these things with ease. He was able to articulate one word, which was mama, but he had difficulty with most everything, although he did learn then how to say P in just a few minutes, like papa. But it was very obvious to them that he had trouble with this, and instead of now, when we speak, which usually on the exhale, isn't it? I mean, but he was doing it in hardly above a whisper, and he was doing it on inhalation. So that should have told us something. For some of this, it reminds me, because the chief and I just saw recently again the play, The Miracle Worker. And I'll have maybe more to say about that later, but it sort of reminds us of Helen Keller as far as some of the problems here of teaching them. But in this case, they just couldn't articulate it. And I won't tell you all about it. There's some people who raised these chimpanzees for long periods of time and tried to study them. One of them had a chimpanzee for many years, and then they, some years later, they got a child and raised the child, raised them in the same way, and made observations on how they learned to articulate and the difference among them. And they made notes on how the chimpanzee communicated, and they kept track. I think some of them, they recorded about 25 various sounds, not language, but some sounds that meant various things to them. The most involved study, and probably the best study. I should point out one other one. It was Gua, G-U-A. The Kellogg's, husband and wife, I think it was, obtained Gua when she was 7.5 months old. And they worked with her for a very long time down at near Yerkes in Florida, near Winter Park, or Orange Park. And they, they observed the various signs on her and interpreted them, and she had a barking kind of a sound, a food bark, a screech or a scream, and then a sort of an ooh cry. But she also learned the word. It was rather easy for him to get pa-pa out of this thing. The most concentrated attack on this was by the Hays. And they obtained Vicky when she was very young. I think they got it from Yerkes Laboratories. Or it was associated, I guess, with Yerkes Laboratory. And they kept Vicky in their home for 6 years. And they really worked on her, trying to teach her language. And after 6 years, she finally got four words: mama, papa, cup, and up. That was the extent of it. So that's about how it was until Alan and Beatrice Gardner at the University of Nevada, who had studied animals in the wild. They made also, I suppose, they'd talked to Jane Goodall and observed her studies on chimpanzees in Africa. Maybe it was in Gambia, as I recall. And they decided to try the gestural language, the American Sign Language, or a modification of it. And so they obtained Washoe, W-A-S-H-O-E. That's the name of the county in which Reno, Nevada is. That's what they called her. And they set up a trailer and a big fence and a sort of a home situation. And they always had somebody in attendance. So the somebody was always observing her. And they began then seeing the various things they'd do and see the kind of signs she might make. And then they kept working on her to teach her the American Sign Language, which is used by the deaf. And they did this because of their observations in the wild, that they noted that they did a lot of gesturing. And it worked. They began, I think, the first year they got up to, I don't know, Chief can probably recall some of this because he's lectured on this, probably 10 words or so. And they arranged the living so it was a rather good situation, so she could, there was a lot of things to work with. And she extended the things like tickling, the sign for tickling, and she'd put the things together, more tickling, or if you romp with them, she wanted more romping. And the word open, the sign for open, was used first for a door. And then it got to be all doors. And then it was opening the faucet. And the flower, the sign for small, was for flowers and then any flavors or odors, or even tobacco. That was something that smelled. And they also, it was interesting, she made some mistakes, because what they would do is sure the sign for a cat or something else, which she'd get right. And then they'd show her a picture of it, and she'd sign for baby. You see, it was a replica, you see, it was a miniature of the full thing. So, you know, they're kind of thinking about this, maybe. After 1 year, she put the words together. As I mentioned, more tickling, or gimme tickle. And she learned some things, but she also made up some things. The refrigerator where they kept the food, open food drink. And that was her own creation to put that together. And also they were having trouble with her on her bib. And she didn't always do the bib right. I think they used this kind of a sign for the bib. But she wouldn't always do it. And finally, they had her in a situation where they were going to kind of press her to do this, and she finally went like this, or like this, you see, and so they went along with her on this. And one day when they were visiting and talking in Berkeley, California, I think it was, with some American Sign Language people, they found out that's what really it is in American Sign Language. This is how you make it. And one day, she saw some Brazil nuts across the room. And she said, "Give me rock berry." Her own creation. By 21 months, she had 34 signs. By 3 years, she had 85 signs. And on the fourth year, she had double these. Now, the gardeners took on a number of graduate students, and one of them was Roger Fouts. And I'm going to come back to that. And because Awash Shu by this time is several years older now, and the gardeners wanted to do something else, use a different approach, and he was going to move to a primate center, the Institute for Primate Research at Oklahoma. And I'm going to pick that story up in a little while, because I want to tell you about some others before I come back to her. I'll go to California now, down to University of California, Santa Barbara. There was a fellow there named David Primack. I think he now is at Pennsylvania. But he was interested not so much in how they communicate, but intelligence among these things, to study intelligence. And he obtained Sarah, who was a six-year-old chimpanzee. And he developed a program to teach her, and he was interested too, of course, in autistic children, aphasic children, children that can talk and retarded. And he used plastic chips of different colors and shapes and placed them on a magnetized board. And he'd put the question, he taught her what they meant, and then he'd put the question on the board. Like, "And give apple Sarah," or questions such as this, and she caught on pretty fast. And sometimes she would change the question so that you have a yes answer rather than a no answer. She'd go up there and shift them. She would also steal symbols from the teacher and form her own question and answer. But she became incorrigible. She'd go into tantrums. If she made a mistake, she became violent. And I don't know if you know it, but they're about 4 to 6 times stronger than we are for a given body weight. I mean, they're powerful and hazardous. And she got so bad that they had to put her away. And so he got some others then. I think he got two of them, Elizabeth and Peony, and you see a lot of difference in them as you do in people. Elizabeth, she really enjoyed learning, and she just had a great time learning and learned very rapidly. Peony only did enough to get by, and she'd rather beg than really learn. But before they gave up on Sarah, she was good at conjunctional things, conditional interrogations. She understood the word structure. She knew, understood pluralization, and it was rather remarkable. I'll tell you about another one named Lana. And Lana is at Atlanta, and she's with Yerkes at the primate laboratory there, and they have some cooperative work with the Georgia State University, I think, and University of Georgia. And the Rumbaugh, they've made the headlines in this year, in fact. And what they did was to teach a new language. It has about 50 symbols on the typewriter. And it's called Yerkish. And it's a keyboard. It has 25 letters on it. And this is set up to a projector and a PDP-8 computer so that anything she puts on there, it would manifest itself on the screen. It will also be recorded in a projector. And they would communicate with her. They might ask a question or start out a question. And she then had to correct it or extend it, modify it, answer it. And this is how she'd ask for, make her request through that, and they would reply to her. And she was able to label, name objects, and concepts. She'd put use syntax, that is, she'd go into sentence structure, word arrangement, go into the meaning of words on semantics. And it's really fantastic, the progress you'd make. And you see, then you have it all in a computer so you can analyze it on correct responses. A very fascinating study. And now I'm going to take you back to Fouts. Now, here you have Washu, and you're going to Oklahoma. Now, how do you get to Oklahoma with Washu? Well, you couldn't very well go down to United Airlines, although they do fly there. But you might have to transfer, I guess. And you wouldn't go up, you'd get a regular ticket, would you? That would be very disturbing to some of the other partners. You wouldn't want to put her down in steerage. Well, what they did, he hired a pilot. I chartered a plane, and we'd fly to down Norman, Oklahoma. But the pilot, he wasn't too sure about this. They gave Washu some tranquilizers, but just as he climbed on his plane, he was noted to take one of these big fire axes in with him. But it was an uneventful trip. And they got to Oklahoma, Norman, Oklahoma, and of course this was a new environment for Washu. And this was her first experience with ducks. She saw those ducks out in the water, and she didn't have a word for it, so she made up her own word, water birds, because she had new birds, and so these were water birds. She signed for it. And she met a monkey for the first time. She met a squirrel monkey, and she named that a bug. I don't know why, but she called it a bug. And not long after this, she was introduced to a rhesus, a rhesus macaque, and they're kind of miserable creatures. They're hard to get along with. And it threatened Washu. It started giving Washu a bad turn. So she didn't sign for bug. She signed for dirty bug, dirty monkey. Now up to that time, the only time she used dirty was for excrement or something very dirty. And then they got worried, you know, will she always call all monkeys dirty monkeys? And so they took her back to the squirrel monkey, and she just signed for monkey or bug. But they also noted ever after, when anybody crossed her up, when her teacher crossed her up, she didn't sign for teacher, she signed for dirty teacher. So she learned a bad word. And she began signing to other chimps, but of course they didn't answer. And if some little monkeys or chimps were distressed, she'd sign for, come on over and I'll hug you. But they didn't come. She also was a little deceptive about it. When the food was passed out and it was a competitive situation, she'd sign to the other chimps to go and get a drink. I should say also, she had a sense of humor. Some of these have a sense of humor. In fact, she was learned to sign for funny. I think it's this. And they'd pull something funny, and if she thought it was funny, she'd laugh. That's how you laugh in American Sign Language. What they were doing there, I should tell you that the gardeners, they were interested in starting earlier with a known situation and raise some young chimps with deaf children. And I haven't heard the latest on that. But I did talk to, I called up Fouts a few months ago to get the latest on this, and I'll give you that in a little while. What they were doing a few years ago was to train Bruno and Bowie. They were 2.5-year-old chimps. They were going to get them up to about 36 signs and then introduce them to Washu and to see what the interchange would be, if they would sign and communicate. And the other thing they were going to do with Washu was to get her pregnant and then see if she would teach her offspring the sign language and communicate that way. Now, I have sad news for you in this regard, because she aborted this last winter, but she is, I think by now, she is with a child again. So we're looking forward to what will happen here to see, in fact, whether she will then teach her little one how to do this. Now, Roger Fouts is also working with several others. He is studying Selamy, which is a chimp that's being raised with a girl named Robin in a home, and he's trying to teach them American Sign Language. Now, Robin doesn't know American Sign Language, but she understands chimp language because she's raised with this, and she knows all the signs of the chimp, and she can understand chimp language. They use some vocal sounds, and she can imitate them. So that's kind of an interesting development. They also have Allie, who is a real star. She knows how to sign, and is very deliberate, and knows quite a few words. And she's also raised with a person. And she also knows some English. She understands quite a bit of English, quite a few English words. Now, the most interesting one of these is Lucy. Lucy, and it's kind of a sad story, really. Lucy was, I suppose, now about 12 or 13. Does that sound right, Chief? I know. I think she's about that. When he first studied her, she was 8, and she had lived from childhood with a family. And she was just like a member of this house. And she also had her cat, called Lucy's Cat. That was the name of it. And that's a pretty good name. She would get up in the morning. She had her own room. And she'd get up and cook tea. She liked tea. But she was a little impatient on heating the water. She sometimes would use the water on the tea bag before it really got hot. And she wasn't too real good at pouring it. She'd sometimes miss. But she enjoyed tea. She'd usually get up and cook herself. And Roger Fouts got a hold of her and started teaching her the American Sign Language. And she was pretty good at it and got to know, call fruits and vegetables and all things like that. And she classified radish in this. And one day she bit into a radish, which she first called food, and then she labeled herself "cry hurt food," because it was a pretty strong radish. A watermelon. Her first introduction of watermelon was, she called it candy drink or candy fruit drink. That was her own name for it. They were hoping also to artificially inseminate her. But she would go with her cat. She'd play with her cat, and she'd go out in the tree, and they'd climb the tree together. Sometimes the cat wasn't all that hot for it. One day the cat cut her leg. He got her leg hurt. And she was very distressed, and she wouldn't let the cat walk. She carried her around and kept signaling that that they better do something. It was a hurt leg, and she signed for this, and she wouldn't give up till they did something about it. One of the more funny incidents was one day, of course, Lucy was trained to use the bathroom, and she hadn't paid that much attention to the cat, and they had a litter box. And one day, she happened to look over there, and here was Lucy's cat in the litter box, and she got sight of it, and she went running over there and grabbed her and hauled her into the bathroom. You know, you do that in the bathroom. Messed up the whole house. And she often signed to the cat with not much response. She would also sit before the mirror and sign to herself and answer herself, and then she'd comb herself, all her hair clear down, you know, the whole works. The bad news on this is that the family that had her broke up. And they wouldn't listen to reason, what I think is reason. And they got some bad advice, and they sent her to Gambie to try to get her rehabilitated to the wild. And there's probably no way, that it's going to be rehabilitated, at least to Fouts. Fouts was almost in tears when I talked to him. He was really, really sad because he loved her. You know, like, it's a great animal and the possibilities, you see. And then they're doing that to her in a situation that he's sure that she will not survive. Before I conclude, I want to tell you about an event that happened down at the Bangkok laboratory. I told you my friend went down there, and I know several of the people that worked in his laboratory. It was a research laboratory where they were studying malaria and dengue fever and a lot of things. And it was a kind of, because it was the biggest gibbon colony in the world, they would have a lot of visitors. And one day, a group of nurses came to tour it. And the tour leader was the executive officer for the laboratory. And as he did with all groups, he told them about the colony. And he said, now there's some things I have to tell you. These animals are very quick, and they're very strong, and they have very long arms, and they can reach out and quite a ways and get you. And so you want to stay clear of the cages, leave some room between you. And so he led the group through, and they were gone down through the various cages, and one of the nurses either had not paid attention to him or became very intent on watching one of these, and she got too close. And this chimp reached, or rather this gibbon reached out and grabbed her and partially disrobed her. And the executive officer, a gallant man that he was, ran over there to extricate the clothes and the nurse from the gibbon. And the gibbon, with his other hand, reached over here and picked out some papers out of the commanding officer, or the executive officer's pocket, which happened to be the speech that he was going to deliver at the close of the lecture. And the gibbon was then observed to retreat to a high perch, and he opened up the speech as if to read it. Then he tore it all up and watched it drop to the bottom of the cage. I thought that was a pretty good story. And it's true. Now, what I've tried to do for you here in these few minutes, and the time is very near up, is that this two-way communication between and among the higher primates is interesting in itself, but it's also for other reasons, so that we can understand these animals better, and also that we might learn something that may help people who are unable to articulate as we understand articulation, to help them and understand the process. And we have learned something about this, I think, from the Rumbas and others. One of my great concerns, and it was even before I read Helen Keller, I believe there are probably, well, I know, there are a lot of people today who are in institutionalized and otherwise, that we, or even in our homes, who we put down. We don't communicate with them, and we treat them as if they do not understand us. Yet they probably may register most of this stuff maybe even better than we do. And that's true. And it's a very frightening thing to me. And I want to sensitize you to that. In fact, there was a recent report where this lady turned out to be, they just discovered, I think, at the age of 65 or 70, she'd been institutionalized most of her life. In reality, she was really very bright. And they just figured it out. And that's too long to wait. I also hope that that you and point out to you that in working with animals, it is very important to have a sensibility and a sensitivity to them and with them. And the greatest of these is sensitivity. And you can really only appreciate them when you become one with them. And to the younger people here, I would emphasize that, as I do every chance I get, is that in the whole field of biology and medicine, we've made a lot of progress, and we have made quite a bit of progress in the last few decades. In fact, I suppose during my lifetime, During my scientific lifetime, we have probably learned more about biology and medicine than in all the time before. Yet we know so little. I could sit here for the rest of the week and write down all the things we don't know. Just here, we're just barely touching something here. Or the other night when I talked about pheromones. There's so much we do not understand. There are so many exciting things yet to be discovered. And we can learn much of it from animals. And I'll close with one story. It isn't about a primate, but it's about a dog, on observations on dogs that I have made. And I've watched a lot of dogs. In fact, one time we had a colony of 12 ton of beagles. That's over 1,000. That's a lot of beagles. But I've watched quite a few mother dogs. And if you keep very good track on mother dogs, you'll find that you'll probably comfort, gentle, and nuzzle her pups about 9 times more often than she growls at them or snaps at them. I've also watched a lot of mothers, and sometimes I think the reverse is true. Mothers growl at them, and or parents growl at them and threaten them about 9 times more often than they nuzzle them, gentle them, and love them. Now, that isn't to say that when you discipline them, you don't love them. But maybe there's a lesson in here for us. Although I was watching a mother today at the second story, Orn. She's the mother of Isaac. And she was, I was counting them, and she only got after him once. And that was when he threw a book down that hit somebody on the first level. That kind of woke up the group. It's a good trick, I think. You kind of wake up your audience. I didn't have anybody up there today. You can do this. But she gentled him about, I counted 6 times during that hour. So I thought that was pretty good. We're making progress. Well, that's all I'm going to give you today, this in this substitute lecture.